I'd like to come from a position of looking at the issue not as one of being a problem with homosexuals or the homosexuality, but of a problem with our response to homosexuality, and which is a term called homophobia, fear of homosexuals. And for the first thing on the board here, we have the range of contemporary theological opinion, which I got out of the book of Embodiment, which I'm sure everybody here is aware of. Has everybody seen this book or know which one I'm speaking about? Okay. And there's four ranges, supposedly, first one being rejective, punitive orientation, and I guess that means to reject the homosexual and to punish the person as well. And today there's no major contemporary theologian who holds this opinion. Contemporary theologians. I don't know. Anyway, I don't know if you can call him a theologian. I don't know. I shouldn't be saying that on tape. Huh?
Businessman?
Beg your pardon?
Instead of a theologian, businessman?
I don't know. Yeah, that's what I'd say. Politician. The second one is the rejecting non-punitive position, which Karl Barth seems to advocate. I know when I was in school, the rejecting non-punitive position is one that is you don't affirm the person's homosexual behavior, but you don't punish them either. And when I was in college, I know that was went to a Methodist school, Virginia Wesleyan College, and the head of the Department of Religion thought similar to that, had held that viewpoint personally. And at that time, I didn't have any opinions, you know, or not many, or much of one, and about the subject. But he was a real Karl Barth follower. That's takes us down to the third one, qualified acceptance, which is, I don't know how to pronounce that, theologian,
Helmut
Thielicke. And that's one of acceptance of the person, yet not the behavior, basically. They can, if they can change, then it's recommended change their orientation. If they can't change, then be celibate. If they can't be celibate, well, then do it, but know that you're sinners. The act of sinning is of sin, unlike heterosexual relationships. So if there's no problems with that, I've deleted or I've not taken the time I didn't think was necessary for us to go back to biblical sources and try to disqualify the prejudices against the homosexual. If that's okay with you all, I'm not going to touch on that area. I think if there's any questions, there's plenty of resources here and plenty of tapes, and they seem to don't get past that point, you know, of the scriptures. Of, I just think for us, it's not necessary. Is that okay? Is everybody in full agreement with that? And we could, Carolyn, do you have a question about that?
Oh, did I understand you correctly to say that number three, the qualified acceptance, was acceptance of the person and of the necessity or someone acting out a homosexual relationship, but that the qualification was that it would be considered
right
sin?
Yes, ma'am.
But any theologian would also say that we all live in sin.
Right, but the particular act is still an act of sin.
One of the sins.
Right. We're all fallen people, they said in this book, yet that particular act is definitely sin, so don't try to pretend that it's not normal, and we won't accept that as being normal or idealized. Right. Yes, ma'am. So that's the point of view from the qualified acceptance.
I guess my question really was, what's the difference between that and number?
Rejecting?
Number two, because rejecting means also that they're saying it's sin, I assume. But if it's non-punitive, then how is that different than three?
I don't know if if they'd even accept the person in the accept hearing anything about being gay or give them a chance. I don't know if they'd even allow them in the church in the rejecting part of it. Okay. Whereas a qualified
you could be non-accepting and still not be non-punitive. There would be a difference there. Yeah,
okay.
That's fine.
I think that's the point. Okay. And so those are the different ranges, and like I said, I like to go just assuming that we hold number four, full acceptance, and then go on from there to talk about homophobia, because I think that's the problem with our society, and it's a prejudice. We are prejudiced against this minority group, which we call homosexuals, and it comes out in fear, and we call it homophobia. And if we accept it as being just a different form, an alternative form of sexual preference, and that's right and good in its essence, then we can look at what is causing all the divisions and fractions and the confusion and hatred and violence over this issue. And I seem to think, and I think others do too, that it's the homophobic, our response to that.
I like your earlier statement a little better, rather than saying this is a place where we're all at.
Okay.
Saying this is where we all are striving.
Right.
Heading towards, because as long as we have a problem of homophobia, I think part of it is that we haven't fully reached.
No, we haven't.
Number four.
Right.
If we really accept and be in everything, why are we fearful of it?
Exactly.
So
we're struggling to become.
Yeah. Or that many of us feel that this is what we would like to.
Right. Envision, that's true. And it goes for the homosexual as well, because they also can be phobic, and they are phobic. It's culturally oriented as well, and no one escapes it, it seems like. And but anyway, the one of the next thing I put up here is a couple words that's been coined. First one, you know, homophobia. The second one is what we're trying to become here in accepting homosexuals. It's called, if I'm not mistaken, homophile. And what I've done is just divided a homophobic standpoint from a homophile. And homophile, I'll read the definition to you. I moved on to this book, Society and the Healthy Homosexual, which was written in 1973. It talks about it. It's very insightful, I think. When was it declared by the Medical Association of Psychiatry to be not a mental illness, homosexual? 75, we're saying, somewhere around that period. Could have been 77. I think it was in the 70s.
I thought it was 78, between 78 and 80.
So this is a real insightful point of view, progressive point of view for Dr. George Weinberg, who's a psychologist, public psychology, and his work is working and has been working with that group of people, counseling. And he recognized the issue back then as being one of homophobia and not the problem with homosexuals. So, and anyway, some of the words that I didn't even know this word existed until I read this book. And it helps to be able to name things, I tell you. To put a name on it is you know what you're working with. You can get a handle on some things. 119. And this word homophile has done that for me, at least a little bit. Homophile, okay, definition. Any humane person who has given serious attention to the status of the homosexual in our society and pitches in to help, even by arguing the cause at cocktail parties. The practice of attributing homosexuality to all homophiles bespeaks the thought that people are not capable of sympathy for others, but only of self-seeking motives. It is a practice that puts decent people in exactly the category that homophobes put them in. Most heterosexuals so fear the charge of homosexuality that even if their hearts tell them to fight for the cause of homosexuals, they are hesitant. Homosexuals must not make the mistake of discrediting people of goodwill who side with them. The best definition of a homophile was given by Dr. Franklin Kameny off the cuff when interrogated about a heterosexual member of the Washington Madison Society in 1964. She's a civilized person who wants to see a discriminated against group of people. She wants to see their status improved in precisely the same sense that there are many, many, many whites who are active members of the NAACP and, in fact, officers. And I am sure there are many Christians who are members of B'nai B'rith, thank you, Anti-Defamation League. They are civilized people who don't like to see other people persecuted and discriminated against. I think that what we're trying to achieve as in discipleship, this would include becoming a homophile. And some of the things that I have put on the board is just from brainstorming, you know, homophobia, it's rejection of homosexuals, fear of homosexuals, making and finding differences between homosexuals and heterosexuals, presenting persecuting homosexuals by unemployment, alienation, beatings, muggings, murder, and genocide. This isn't a far-fetched thing. This happens every day. People are beat, mugged. Remember the movie we had on Streetwise? Talking, that boy who committed suicide was talking about mugging faggots. It's okay to mug a faggot, you know. You're doing society a favor. That's the attitude even the police hold in many cases. Murder and genocide, World War II, wasn't that part of the plan of the Nazis? Genocide with the homosexual, as well as, that was one of the misfits they wanted to get rid of. And there's murder every day, and there's hostility, and there's just, you know, it's the fear, the homophobia in our society. The homophiles, affirmation, full acceptance, compassion for homosexuals, finding similarities versus differences, recognizing our own fears, awareness of the issues, myths surrounding homosexuals, allowing homosexuals a history. They're like other minority groups. They haven't been allowed any history. You have to really search out, find something on, you know, proclaiming homosexual people in the past as doing something worthy for society. Taking a stand for the rights of homosexuals politically, even in discussion, conversation with our friends, employing the homosexual. And I guess I've written down here a goal to learn more about homophobia in order to become better able disciples of Jesus Christ. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I base that on that being biblical. That's what we're to do. No exclusions.
Even the ones from the scripture that Anna wrote yesterday seem to parallel
yeah.
that too.
Sure. About the
Jew and Gentile and whatever, mm-hmm. male, female, these relations.
Slave, that's right, homosexual or heterosexual. Any differences that we categorize people in. What's next here? All right. So, again, I think the problem is not the not the homosexual, it's our response to the homosexual. So what is it? What is fear of homosexuals? Using this book, page 4 and 5, let's see. What causes homophobia? I'm just going to read some things through here that underlined in connection with this. What causes homophobia? The dread of being close quarters with homosexuals, and in the case of homosexuals themselves, self-loathing. Homosexuality is itself considered a problem in our society. Our unwarranted distress over homosexuality is not classified as a problem because it is still a majority point of view. Homophobia is still part of the conventional American attitude. Despite massive evidence that homosexuals are various in their personalities as anyone else, the public at this time still holds many misconceptions, which in some cases are thought to justify our discriminatory practices. Among these misconceptions are the belief that homosexuals seduce young children, child molestation is predominantly a heterosexual practice, the belief that homosexuals are untrustworthy, that homosexual men hate women, that homosexual women hate men, all beliefs unsupported by evidence but held unquestionably by millions. The fear of homosexuality is inculcated in early life. Studies have been done in which children are asked to place paper figures on a background to indicate the degree of closeness between imaginary persons represented by the figures. The children are asked to indicate that the play figures like each other, that like each other, or are acquaintances, or are frightened of each other. In one study, sixth grade boys and girls were subjects, and the cutouts were of children their own age. The girls showed a strong tendency to indicate fondness by putting the cutouts close to each other. By comparison, the boys did not put the cutouts of boys near to each other. The differences were so systematic as to meet stringent scientific criteria, their researchers concluded. It is common knowledge that in our society, females are allowed to assume closer physical interaction distances than males are. Sex differences in interpersonal spacing have been found on numerous occasions, and observation shows that females can tolerate closer physical presences than males in this culture. Society's fear of intimacy between males has implications far beyond the sexual realm. Apparently, boys learn it by the age of 11, and it results in a significant deprivation of freedom for them. I can remember personally at age 12, you know, going into seventh grade, leaving elementary school, you know, there's a different plateau or something of manhood, you know. And I remember my best friend Sean and I were walking down the street, Patton Boulevard, it was in Alexandria, but anyway, I'd known him since he was 6 years old. We'd known each other since we were six. We're best friends, just like that, couldn't be any closer. And for some reason, you know, I can identify so strongly with that. He put his arm around me to walk, shoulder to shoulder, and at that point, I felt real uncomfortable, and I asked him not to do that, but he continued to do that, and I actually took his hand away. As at 12 years old, I mean, at that age, I could barely say anything. I wasn't even sexually oriented at all, you know, not what I consider sexually orientation. Don't even think I ever kissed a girl, you know, that way. Or so how would, you know, at that age, it's there. And I thought about that, reflected on that many times since then, and that bothers me. It really does. It did deprive me of the freedom to show emotion early on. Do you mind if I read something that's not
kosher?
Oh, well, that's a Gentile term, I guess. Okay. But it makes a point, and that's what I wanted to get across. It's not the study, but an Australian psychiatrist named Dr. N. Carnegie, conducted a study typical of many in which the aim was to help perfect a device for spotting homosexuals. Only know who knows why, but this in the study, he puts the penis of each of his subjects into an apparatus designed to measure whether it expanded or contracted at the subject's viewed picture. As the subjects viewed pictures of nude men and women engaging in somewhat suggestive acts, like toweling themselves. 11 heterosexual medical students served as the controls for a homosexual population. In responding to the pictures of the nude males, the penises of the heterosexual young medical students shrank. One understands easily why they did not expand, since presumably the medical students were not erotically aroused at the sight of the nude males. But why do they shrink? And he says the answer is fear. And consider the implication of this. If the sight of the naked bodies of the male had this effect on the medical students, how will it influence them as practitioners when they will be called upon to look at and handle the naked bodies of men? When a phobia incapacitates a person from engaging in activities considered decent by society, the person himself is the sufferer. Bringing out a point that men suffer from homophobia more so than women, I want to say that according to the studies, men have a harder time being intimate. And I don't think it's anything new, but I think that's just one of the causes of that.
And
yes.
Of you males here traveled in any countries where that cultural background is not so rigid, where
no.
You do hold hands on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Yeah. I was just interested in how that affects you as a man who was trained that,
don't do that.
Doesn't do that. Because in some cultures that is acceptable.
Right.
Where did you see that?
Oh, many places, Papua New Guinea, maybe.
Sure. It's just friendship,
even
but
you
not
see
here.
In Africa, that women hold hands or even, have an arm around, so men do the same, whereas women and men don't do that in public.
So,
yeah, so it's within the
men do it and
the
women
same
do it,
sex
but not,
that you do
not
it.
Opposite.
But not that's, where was that? Where is it?
In Tanzania.
Tanzania.
Even
yeah.
Married couples will not show
emotion.
Public.
I'll be doing it.
I was going to say.
Oh, I'm not used to that.
Oh, I'm not.
Oh.
But Germany, I think it is too. Our German
especially
missionary friends, they were very used to that.
In Scotland, I saw many, many men walking down the streets at night, long, and both hand in hand, arm in arm, or arm in arm.
Scotland.
I didn't know that. Sure.
Pigeon dropping, I like that term. Pigeon dropping onto that one. And further reflections and embodiment. There's, I meant to bring that up. And
get back to that book. Did they ever have a report on what happened when they had female pictures?
I think that was what they're talking about, that they had the erections, the medical students had the erections because of the females' pictures first. But then when they showed the males, why did the penises shrink from the full erection, so soon, I guess, it doesn't make much sense. I think that's what they were talking about, but they shrank. I mean, they wouldn't expand, but why would they shrink? And it's fear of being labeled homosexual or even having any kind of feelings, seeing that. Even curiosity, can't allow yourself curiosity. That's questionable then. Recognizing that we can't hold hands, and we can't, kiss males, or the males kiss males. I mean, even when it comes to parental units, it's not, sometimes it's a problem. At some point in life, one says, seems like it's a decision that's made, either to continue kissing your father or not, or not trying to. I have ignored that and continue to kiss my father and upon greetings and saying goodbye. I'm not uncomfortable, and he's not either. We never talked about it. I think we did briefly, but we just affirmed that we would continue to do that. On the other side of the coin, with my grandfather, my step-grandfather, but he's been a grandfather all my life, I had to stop that, which recently, because I felt that he was uncomfortable. And being sensitive to that person, I didn't talk to him about that. I just, we hug now, and we don't read each other. I have two sisters, so everybody kisses when they, you know, and it's okay. But when I step up there, it's not okay, so it's like a little awkward. So I have to make, it becomes real apparent that these decisions are I have to make. And in further reflections from issue of full acceptance of this, being aware of people's homophobia or sensitivity about these things, Reinhold Niebuhr, is that close? Argued that Christians must learn to live with the tension of having and have and not having the truth. Okay, that tolerance, in the truest sense, he maintained, comes when we can have vital convictions which lead to committed actions, and at the same time recognize that our own truth is always incomplete and subject to distortion. Living with convictions, we also then live within the reality of divine forgiveness and with respect for the convictions of those who sincerely differ from us. That spirit is always essential, I believe, but when we confront issues like homosexuality, on which feelings are particularly deep and divided, it is especially crucial. So being sensitive to other people, like I was with my grandfather, that phobia there, that uncomfortableness, I have to respect and find another way of saying hello and goodbye, which we settled on nonverbally in hugs. But I think that's important, you know, to realize too, in any issue, according to Ryan, this man here, Reinhold Niebuhr, but especially with this issue on homosexuality and phobia towards it.
I think even the hugs is a step forward for our society.
Sure.
The male hugs.
It is.
Even that, so.
Definitely. And that's another biggie. That's right. You're right. No question. Hugging another male is risk-taking in this society. Okay. Talks about continuing in this book, some chief reasons that we have prejudice towards the homosexual. The root. Let's sit right down. Religious motive, the secret fear of being homosexual, repressed envy, the threat to our values, and existence without vicarious immortality, another value of our society. In the religious motive, it goes back to the Judeo-Christian code. I'm not spilling the seed. This includes the homosexual. I told you I wasn't going to bring all this biblical questions up, but that was one of the reasons, chief reasons, for having such a hang-up in this area. Yes.
I didn't want to interrupt you.
Go ahead, Greg.
What's the view of homosexuals in Denmark?
Oh, I think that we should let John finish his presentation and then get around to more general.
I didn't know if you were done or not.
No, I'm still
okay.
A little bit more to go.
Yeah, I think
that'd be okay.
Sure,
correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. And this came under, you know, we started making laws to punish and reject homosexuals. And according to some readings, it didn't really happen until the Middle Ages. but I'm not sure on that. Don't quote me. But I think it really became illegal during the Middle Ages to conduct oneself this way. And it came under the term of canon law, versus different from common law, which is common law is concerned with protecting people from damage inflicted by others, and canon law is protecting people from themselves. Or I imagine suicide would be a canon law. And so the person doesn't have the right to decide what's even dangerous for themselves. And it's canon law, okay? And that was one of the ways prejudice entered our society,
before
culture.
Before the Middle Ages, there wasn't such a rigid social pattern.
Right.
That actually homosexuals were accepted before.
Yeah, in fact, one of the books I was reading talks about if you really want to get a good tutor, back in the Greek days.
Oh yeah, the Greek days.
Right.
Yeah.
And even I guess it's during the Italian Renaissance, somebody that kind of thought came in there too, that an older man would indoctrinate a younger man, teach him the arts, but and also teach him romantic love, mm-hmm. that it couldn't be paid for. And any other way besides a relationship, a loving sexual relationship. I mean, that's how we would show and have time to do that concept. And that became something, yeah. I imagine, of a model.
I think I was thinking more of my own context, like among peasants in Northern Europe and so on.
I don't know if it was a real issue there either.
Social.
Doesn't seem to be. Doesn't seem to be. I don't know. What do you think, Elmer? Yeah. The word, what was that word? Gernermede or something?
Yeah.
You remember? It was a term coming from the man Gernermede, who was lived during 400 AD or BC. I'm confused now, but back during that time, and somehow it was coined after him. Maybe, I don't know what kind of it was. He had a relationship that way, an outward relationship, and he held a high office. Many people held high offices that were homosexual during the Greek era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't unusual, and it wasn't considered. You see, because the thought was back then that women were inferior, and that to have a real true relationship, loving relationship, you had to be mutual, and you couldn't be mutual with a woman, so that was considered legitimate.
Yeah, so like the philosophers would have both, they would have a wife and a
yeah.
family, and they would have a
lover.
Yeah.
Right, so the double standard even goes back that far. You know, it goes back to the beginning of a lot of our Western culture. What was the point I was trying to make? Do you remember? About
in the Middle Ages.
Right. It wasn't a problem. It wasn't an issue, right. So it became a law during that later mm-hmm. point. And there's a lot of, I was reading last night some poetry from homosexual poetry and literature during the 11th and 12th century, and I didn't bring it, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And but it depicted the woman as being less than desirable.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's where many of the myths come in today that we hold, that men hate women, or you know,
yeah.
gay men hate women.
The history that you did read was the most about lesbians, or was it mostly gay men?
Mostly gay men, because you see, lesbians, we don't, back then, it was the lesser of the lesser of peoples. And even today, it holds true. You know, if women were lesbians, it didn't really matter, because they weren't how to explain this, women were less stature, so it really didn't matter as much. You know, they weren't in the limelight. There wasn't much written by women anyway that we know of, but they didn't have a history back then, did they? Recorded history. The literature that I read was on men, from men's point of view.
And most of them were written by men.
Yeah. Right, right.
Is it like even with Boswell wrote?
Right, exactly. John Boswell. And that today, you know, even in society, women are not persecuted for being lesbians like men are. They are, but not violently. And that's well, a couple reasons this person gives is that the lesser the lesser, you know. That why for a man to give up his traditional role and place in society, his privilege of being a man, to be effeminate, is a much greater threat to us, talks about this in the values, than a woman being passive and being, she's a lesser anyway. And it's sort of even, they're not really that threatening to our system. You know, we allow women to be close, and then if they go closer, it doesn't matter because they don't really keep the engines oiled, you know, and the spokes going. And if, on the other side, they do become butch, that's a term of being a homosexual woman, then it just reinforces the fact for men that this is what we should be, you know, this is the better. And the woman's just trying to externalize all that, trying to become a man because they have a better place in society, and that, I don't know if they're threatening or not. They sort of reinforce the values.
Threatening they're being the silk of the women who don't seem to need a man.
Right, they're independent of men. But then again, they're reinforcing that men, a man, to be a man in the society is where it's at, you know? Because they put on the appearance or have in the past of being manlike, manly. Right, and men don't do that with being...
No, a lot of women don't.
No, but in the past, I think it's true, more so than now. Short haircuts, men's clothes, wanting to be career-oriented. You know, all those things, which I'm not denying. I'm just saying that it's reinforced our values. And where men don't put on women's clothes because they're homosexual, you know, they don't dress up like women. Those are more heterosexual men that do that. But, so you see my point I'm making?
Mm-hmm.
About women not really being in the historically or standing out.
I was just asking because I don't know much about it.
I don't either.
I'm not
right, but I don't know any woman's history from about, you know, gay or not gay. Read very little on women or on black history. You know, main perspective of school has been on white men doing things. You know. Greg, yes.
Talking about persecution, it made me think of this film that Ron brought in from Spokane, that Streetwire.
Right.
I don't know if people saw it or not, but that dyke that was in that film,
Lulu,
was looked like she was really persecuted all the time. It was constantly in argument.
Well, I think she was an antagonistic sort of personality, you know, in those streets. I didn't see her as being a passive in any way, you know. And she was murdered not too long after that. Yeah, she was murdered by in a dispute over her lover at a bar, I understand, down in Seattle. Yeah, a refugee, Central American refugee made a pass at her lover, and they got into a quarrel and he stabbed her. But anyway, that's another issue. And the second reason this Weinberg gives for homophobia is a secret fear of being homosexual. And Freud calls this reaction formation or something, the mechanism of defending an impulse in oneself by taking on a stand against its expression by others. Wondering, not looking inside or recognizing our own feelings, but projecting it, displacing it upon others, and then persecuting them. You know, if we persecute somebody so much we can't be like that, we're the persecutors. We're the ones trying to clean up that situation, whatever, And then repressed envy, it's a third motive. And according to this, the heterosexual is looking for differences and trying to think of himself as successful and possess some particular attributes. And the homosexual man threatens this, threatens his manhood, threatens the fact that the homosexual can be happy and live a normal life without paying the price for sex, like the heterosexual man cannot, so he thinks, he's had to sacrifice, be the breadwinner, child raiser, or, to some degree, it's been a heavy price to pay for this sexual favors from his wife or from his girlfriend. He's had to put out the bucks, whereas a homosexual man doesn't have to worry about children, doesn't have to worry about a family or being the breadwinner. They both are. It seems, and they can still be happy. That's what, it's threatening to that. So it's a repressed envy of that not having to pay the price to play the game. It's a real base interpretation of someone thinking that way, but yeah, Greg.
Is that what the author says? Or is that your view?
That's what the author says here. Your success with women isn't necessarily so important for the happiness as you imagine, says the homosexual. And look at all you've had to sacrifice for it. This is what the heterosexual thinks the homosexual is saying to him. Of masculinity, he seems to be saying that attribute of yours means nothing. Here I am with no desire to possess it, no desire to possess it. But homosexual man is much more apt to be regarded as threatening on this score than the homosexual woman. Most men are taught from early childhood that to engage in homosexual acts would be to surrender their masculine identity. He goes on to talk about the identity problem as well, which is tied into that. These men's personal success appears to demand that they go on conveying an impression of themselves which is so far from the fact that they cannot possibly manage to perfect it. That's the heterosexual man trying to appear masculine and trying to keep up all the expectations placed on him about home life, and career, and family man. There's numerous requirements. For instance, they envision the successful man as perennially confident, as dressing well and appropriately at all times, making a good living, commanding respect from his wife, and as in command of where he's going. Without respite, this would be an ideal American man, must toil to appear as what he knows he's not, and since he's apt to believe that lapses should disqualify him from enjoying the culture's rewards and even from love, he is particularly disturbed by the sight of someone who apparently feels no need to assert himself in the same ways. Puritanism was once defined by H.L. Mencken as a lurking fear that someone somewhere is happy and successful. And that's the fear that operates often in the heterosexual view of the homosexual.
I think that's probably the weakest part of the book.
Yeah.
I don't think that's very well substantiated. Pretty stereotypical.
Yeah.
And I think if you wrote the same kind of stuff about a homosexual, you'd be screaming all over the place. And it's pretty hard to back that up with research.
I would think so too, because who really wants to be homosexual? you know, in our culture.
Oh, increasing numbers of people. But I think there's fear, but I don't think the fear is, he's trying to say, what are the fears? That,
you know? Right.
You're going to be fearful without any of that about it.
Right.
The early trade, 11 years old is late for the development of that fear.
Mm-hmm.
Being a sissy or being fruit or whatever, these are used all early on, from 5-6 year olds on.
Right.
And that builds in, and I think a lot of people have that fear without even ever understanding it, without necessarily having to resent having a heterosexual relationship or having a job, because the male in this society gets his goodies
right
out of his job and out of his work, right, out of his salary. And by the way, that's true very much of that homosexual men. People that I know, males especially,
right,
they still have all of those battles,
mm-hmm,
not just the heterosexual. So that part of the book is not what? Substantial to me.
Right.
To me as well.
I would disqualify that too on the grounds that I'm not saying who wants to be homosexual because of preference, but because homosexual in this culture is persecuted.
Sure.
So who would, you know, along those lines?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Right. That's
and also in the sexual relationship, you seem to have two options. That is, if you can agree on it, you can either have a family and you have to, mm-hmm, play the role of breadwinner.
Sure, you can.
Race, etc. Or you can choose not to have children.
Yep, and more and more, that's an option, legitimate option.
And to choose that, to say that's a burden, you know, it's really stereotypical. That's, mm-hmm, some of the greatest joy in life.
It's from family. Yeah.
You know, to say that, just de facto, if you choose to have a child, you are burdened. There's no substantiation to that.
But I think the author says that those are some of the stereotypes, mm, that people perhaps...
One of the... But it's a weak...
Yeah, I've read the book.
I think it is your book.
Yeah. Please point that out. And he's also pointing out, isn't he, all the different fears there might be, and it doesn't mean in any way that everyone, that it would be that aspect.
No.
Homophobia, but that there may be
combining
some people.
I just stand very strongly with my statement. I think it's the weakest part of his book. Mm-hmm. And what he's
drummed up.
Couching. I think he's on thin ice. That's the one of my thoughts. It doesn't mean it isn't true.
Yeah.
My judgment is that he's thin.
I give him a lot of credit. I'm sure you do too for the time he wrote this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I guess. The fourth one is the threat to values, that they're not conforming. And of course, indifferences means that they're knocking the system. Anyone does not adopt to a society's usual value system runs the risk of being seen as undermining the society. Amen. Because the person does not share the interests and goals of the majority, there is the suspicion of him. This remains so even if the person produces as much as others and works as hard over a lifetime. The mere fact that the homosexual is not striving for marriage, for example, makes it harder to include him or her in appeals made to the populace. Then he goes on talking about homosexuals not having a family, and that because they don't have a family, this presents another problem. And it's called existence without vicarious immortality. And one of the things in our culture, notion of that, the homosexual can't extend his life through children, makes us question why we have families, or makes us question about our mortality. And I think that's, upon occasion, I've been asked about, you know, if you don't get married and have a family, who's going to carry on the name? Or that's a way of contributing to the society, a great deed or something. I don't know. We have some kind of immortality that way, which certainly I don't think is biblical. So, or requires much faith. But anyway, he talks about having a family and children, and seeing that love that transfers from the parents to the children. It is real comforting for us, and the fact that the homosexuals don't do that or can't do that because of the nature of things, they can't adopt, but I mean, it doesn't include that, but that we don't see them in a loving role. We don't see that. We see them as attacking the family because they don't have a family, and we don't see anything transpiring between them. And he talks about even gorillas and lions in the zoo have, we have some kind of emotion for them when we see them loving their cubs or mm-hmm. little ones, you know, and that homosexuals don't have this available. So we question that part because we have nothing to, no history.
That's kind of general, too, because there are those married people that are.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't include that populace, nor does it include adoption or people who work with children or people in the church or anything else, you know, but this is all, see, people in these roles we don't see as being gay. They can't, you know, it hasn't been allowed to be recognized.
When was this book written?
73. So that's what? 13 years ago? It's a long, you know, and at that time, again, that was, homosexuality was considered a mental illness. And this person says, no, it's not a mental illness. The chapters I'm discussing, too, you know, they're not about the homosexual. It's about our response to it. The man goes on, I think he's real enlightened, progressive. He talks about, first of all, the book, The Society and the Healthy Homosexual. At that time, it wasn't considered there could be no healthy homosexual. The bias of psychoanalysis. The case against trying to convert. The healthy homosexual. The dread of being alone. He talks about a whole lot of issues for the homosexual. So, I mean, in light of that, I'm just picking out words for a new culture, for instance. Communication. And concentrating on the negative things.
What is this fellow? Is he a theologian? Or?
He's a psychologist.